Chapter 18. Exacting attention to detail had served Perturabo well in his centuries of life. In war and at peace, he revelled in the minutiae of any given task, be it reducing an alien fortress to rubble or establishing the golden ratio within every portion of a theoretical design. Angron had berated him for wasting time on irrelevant details, while Gilliman had lauded him for his thoroughness. Two very different characters, two very different opinions. Both were correct in their own way, but neither fully appreciated his methodology or the bitter drive behind his exacting preferences. The need to be better, the urge to prove his worth beyond taking the metal to the stone. Perturabo was a craftsman, and to be worthy of the appellation, every piece of work that bore his name must be judged for as long as it stood. His legacy was to leave no undertaking unfinished. Every task was approached as though it might be his last, and this was no different. His sanctum was draped in shadows. The grand designs and priceless artworks hung on the walls kept hidden from sight. The automatons were slumped and silent on their shelves, with only the rustle of stacked weapon schemata on curling wax paper to disturb the silence. Not even the distant throb of the Iron Blood's engines intruded upon his introspective isolation. Spread before him like components of the most intricate chronometer imaginable were the pieces of the smashed Warhound automaton. Fulgrim's head had broken it into fragments, and Perturabo was painstakingly repairing it. It had been an act of impulse to destroy the Warhound, one calculated to drive a point home, but impulsive nonetheless. Bent over his workbench, Perturabo gently teased out a bend in a cogwheel, using the microscopic tines of precision calipers to realign each miniature tooth. It would be the work of months to repair it fully, but Perturabo had always believed that once a task was begun, only a lesser man would fail to see it through to the end. 10 days had passed since his assault on his brother. Perturabo did not regret the act, but Forex's words had struck a chord within him. It was foolish to trust to the word of a narcissistic egomaniac. The Trident had urged him to lead the Iron Warrior's fleet from the Eye of Terror, his newly chosen name already gaining currency, and return to the War Master's side. But he had given Fulgrim his oath that he would see this to the end. And that was that. Perturabo knew his brother would betray him. He was resigned to its inevitability. Such individuals could never be relied upon to do anything other than further their own interests, and Fulgrim was no exception. The only question was when the betrayal would come. Speculation was pointless. It would happen, and he would be ready for it. Part of him looked forward to it. At least then he would be freed from his obligation to Fulgrim. Satisfied that the cogwheel was returned to its original form, Perturabo carefully placed it back where it had come from and slotted the tool into its compartment. He straightened and rubbed the heels of his palms over his face. His eyes were heavy and felt gritty, as though he had not rested or had slept badly. Perturabo sat back and poured himself a heavy goblet of wine from a bronze ewer. Bitter and flavoured with almonds and gene-recovered spices from Terra, the beverage was one fermented by a son of the Crimson King. Thinner than the robust Olympian wines, but exciting and full of interesting contradictions, much like the Crimson King himself. He pulled his fur-lined cloak about himself, feeling cold in his flesh and weary to his bones. Of all the things Fulgrim had brought to this mission, Perturabo valued the gift of this cloak the highest. Its fabric was warm, and the workmanship of the skull fastener inhumanly beautiful. The stone at its centre was polished smoother than even he might manage in a lapidary's workshop. It had been black with hair-fine golden threads when Fulgrim had first presented it to him, but was now a melange of gold and black, the former gradually becoming the dominant colour. Perturabo turned the stone, letting it catch the light from the hovering lumen globes.
"An inconstant thing," he said. "The perfect gift from my brother."
Perturabo sighed and returned to the broken warhound, picking up a timing lever and beginning to work the kinks out with a miniature hammer and laser measuring device. The massed fleets of the Iron Warriors and Emperor's Children still plied the tempestuous currents of the warp under the guidance of Karuchi Vora. But their journey was almost over. The Trident were eager to be unleashed to set their grand battalions to war once more. A single warship with a competent navigator could utilize the torrential currents of the warp, slingshotting from squall to squall to make best speed, but to attempt such maneuvers with a large fleet was to invite disaster. Perturabo would not risk such impetuosity, not this deep in the Eye of Terror, where each storm and tempest was strong enough to tear ships apart in the blink of an eye. The paths above were indeed a calm current through the warp, as Karuchi Vora had promised, but to move so many ships through them took time. He didn't trust Vora, just as he did not trust Fulgrim, but he could not say for sure what the guide's true agenda might be. What could a lone Eldar scholar, if that was his true vocation, hope to gain by deceiving them? Barban Falk had standing orders to put a bolt round through the guide's head at the first sign of betrayal, a task he was already hoping he would have to carry out. And then there was the matter of the second ship he had glimpsed when the Sisypheum had inadvertently unmasked itself. None of the ship's surveyor apparatus had registered it, and none of the bridge crew had witnessed it, but Perturabo knew what he had seen. Who else might be on the hunt for the Angel Exterminatus? Imperial forces? Unlikely, for there was every indication that the second ship had been hiding from the Sisypheum as well. Perhaps Karuchi Vora was not as alone as he claimed. Or perhaps there were other races who knew of this mission and sought to thwart its success or profit by its achievement. Further questions were put aside, as a gentle chime sounded from the entrance to his sanctum. Perturabo answered without looking up.
"Enter."
The door opened and Forex stood silhouetted in the stark glare of the vapour lights behind him. In his Terminator armour, he looked invincible.
"My lord," said Forex, "pardon the intrusion."
"What is it, my Triarch?"
"The Eldar says we have reached our destination."
Perturabo waited until he had finished working on the timing lever, the laser telling him it was as straight as it ever would be. He put it and the hammer back in their proper places.
"Have you been able to fix it, my lord?" asked Forex. "The Warhound, I mean."
Perturabo stood with a groan of weariness, sudden pain lancing up his spine.
"A handful of components amongst thousands," he said, rubbing his face. "There's a lesson there somewhere, but I'm too tired to think of it."
Perturabo had never seen a world like it. Like a pearl set in a canvas left out in the rain, it was a pristine bauble in the miasma of boiling energies of the warp. Where other pockets of matter were storm-lashed hellworlds of impossible physics and nightmarish pseudo-realities, this planet had somehow remained untouched, a point of light against a backcloth of impenetrable darkness.
"Wonderful,"
said Fulgrim, his holographic form wavering and crazed with static.
"It is a virgin in a bordello, a regimental mascot in a slaughterhouse."
Fulgrim's image was clad in battle plate, the golden wing of his shoulder guard gleaming even over the patchy holographic connection. There was no sign of the hurt he had suffered at Perturabo's hands.
"Does it have a name?" asked Perturabo.
Karuchi Vora stood beside the command lectern, with Barban Falk, his constant shadow, a pace behind him.
This region of space was once home to a world known as Aedris, said Vora. A world said to have been favoured by the goddess Liliath, but I do not know if this is the same place.
And you're sure this is where we'll find the weapons? Asked Forex. Of course he's sure, snapped Fulgrim. How many other worlds like this do you imagine there are?
This is the place, said Vora. The sorrow I feel just from looking at it tells me so.
What does that mean? Asked Kroger.
This is a crone world, a relic of my people's long-vanished empire, said Vora. A race fell to ruin here, billions of souls lost forever. It is not easy for me to see this.
Perturabo sensed falsehood in Vora's answer, but there was little to be done about it now. They were here, and there was work to be done. He turned to address the hybrid machine shipmaster of the Iron Blood.
Captain Vought, give me a full surveyor sweep of the surrounding area, he commanded. I want to know if there is anything else nearby.
You think the Iron Hands might be here? Asked Fulgrim.
Don't you? He countered.
I think their vessel must surely have been too badly damaged after ramming the Andronicus to have survived much longer than my beautiful ship, said Fulgrim.
Then you're forgetting how resourceful Ferris's sons are, said Perturabo. They've taken enough punishment to cripple a capital vessel and are still flying. That ship's as hard as Olympian bedrock, and it's going to take more than a collision to put it out of the fight.
Assuming you're right, what can one ship do against our mass strength, brother? We have two entire legion fleets, hundreds of vessels, tens of thousands of warriors.
You heard what happened on Dwell?
No, said Fulgrim.
You're lying, said Perturabo, and you should know better than to dismiss any warriors of the Iron Tenth.
They died easily enough on Istvan, sneered Fulgrim.
You have a short memory, brother, said Perturabo. They died hard, and they died fighting, and they're here somewhere.
Soft plainsong issued from the vox grills mounted on the ceiling. A melody without a tune, and a wordless evocation of emotional intensity beyond understanding. The sound permeated every corner of the Iron Blood's bridge, a lyrical note that jarred with the hard edges and uncompromising lines of the space. Even the soft binaric burr of the bridge data engines seemed to still themselves in the presence of the sound.
What is that? Said Kroger. Background radiation and fluxing emissions from the planet, came the bark of the captain's augmetic voice. The Auspex is interpreting it as a vox signal, filtering it out now. Wait, said Perturabo. Leave it.
You hear it too? Asked Fulgrim.
Perturabo nodded.
Yes, that's not interference.
He saw the confusion in the faces of his triarchs and said,
It's a lament.
And a warning, added Fulgrim. I have heard the like of it before, around murder.
A warning of what? Said Forex.
Perturabo shifted the focus of the view screen, and what had been lost in the magnification of the pearlescent world was revealed. The heart of the Eye of Terror. A gravitational hellstorm with a supermassive black hole at its centre. A sphere of polished onyx swirling with colours like oil smears. It was a sucking wound in the flesh of the galaxy that vomited unnatural matter into the void. Whatever cataclysm had brought the Eye of Terror into being, this was its epicentre. A dark doorway to an unknowable destination, and an unimaginably powerful singularity whose gravity was so strong that it consumed light, matter, space, and time in its destructive core.
How is that planet not being dragged in? Wondered Forex. How are we not being dragged in?
Legend says that Lilith was protective of her world and held it tight to her breast, said Karuchi Vora. Not even Marai Heg's black hunger could wrench it from the firmament.
That's no answer, boomed Falk.
It is the only one I have, replied the Eldar guide. The paths above have brought us to Aedris in such a way that whatever force holds this world from destruction and keeps the ravages of the warp at bay keeps us safe, too.
Then we shall be about our business before that changes, said Perturabo, switching the display on the view screen to a topological representation of the planet's surface. Where is the citadel of Amon Naisha Kalis? Show me.
Karuchi Vora nodded and zoomed in on the planet's surface. There was no indication of the world's climate or environment, nothing beyond its superficial geography. Yet Perturabo instantly saw one unique feature of its form. Fulgrim saw it too and said,
It's a perfect sphere.
What does the planet's shape matter? Asked Kroger.
Such ideal geometry is virtually impossible in planetary formation, said Perturabo. The push and pull of gravity from nearby stars and celestial phenomena stretches and compresses planets. Most are flattened ellipses, but this is perfectly spherical.
What could have caused it? Said Forex.
I don't know, said Perturabo. Who truly understands the forces at work in the warp?
There, said Karuchi Vora, and a shimmering crust overlaid the smooth surface of Aedris, a hazed representation of soaring towers, grand palaces and magnificent temples. As the composite image gathered information from the Iron Blood's many surveyors, the spread of structures eventually covered the entire world. A tomb world? Its entire surface given over to mourning and remembrance of the dead, perhaps? No, that wasn't right, but Perturabo couldn't grasp the true nature of this world.
The sepulchre of Isha's doom sits at the centre of Amon Naisha Kalis, said Vora, pointing to a shimmering arrangement of geometric forms at what, on a Terran standard world, would be the northern polar ice cap.
It stands astride the entrance to the prison tomb of the angel Exterminatus.
How is it defended? Asked Perturabo.
This maelstrom was said to be Asurion's best defense against anyone finding the resting place of the angel Exterminatus, said Vora, though some legends speak of an army of immortals who stand sentinel upon the citadel's walls to watch over its weapons. But that is all I know.
Immortals? Said Kroger. Robots, maybe?
Unlikely, said Forex.
Then what?
Perturabo ended their debate by jabbing a fist at the structure Karuchi Vora had indicated.
This is where we will break in, he said. What are the rest of these structures? Why raise a world's worth of buildings if there's no one to put in them?
I do not know, my lord, said Karuchi Vora.
Once again, Perturabo felt the lie uncoil from the Eldar, but Fulgrim spoke before he could understand the heart of it.
What does it matter, brother? We will find out when we make planet fall. A little mystery is nothing to fear.
Perturabo nodded to himself and folded his arms, feeling a chill seep into his bones at the sight of the dead planet before him. His entire body felt numb, and his lungs burned with the effort of breathing. He threw off the lethargy and said,
Falk, I want everything around that sepulchre levelled. Leave an exclusion zone of 3 kilometres from its farthest edge, but everything beyond that, for 100 more, is to be bombed flat.
What? No, cried Fulgrim.
This is my command, said Perturabo, and I don't land a single warrior into a potentially hostile environment without a preliminary bombardment.
You might damage what's below.
Perturabo took note of Fulgrim's phrasing and shook his head.
"Trust me," he said, "if there's one thing the Iron Warriors do better than anyone else, it's launching pinpoint barrages from orbit."
The 4th Legion fleet assumed bombardment formation over Amon Nishak Kalis, their barrage cannons, mass drivers and bomb bays loaded with surface-smashing ordnance, short-burn incendiaries and electromagnetic pulse bomblets. Those ships assigned fire sectors closest to the citadel were loaded with lower-yield munitions, while those tasked with levelling the outer regions prepped the largest warheads. Volley-firing frigates jostled with heavier capital ships as they prepared to rain explosive fury upon the world below. The Emperor's children played no part in the bombardment preparations. Perturabo was unwilling to trust their fire discipline, and Fulgrim declined to bombard a world he had coveted for so long. Within an hour of the order's issue, the last assigned ship in the Iron Warriors' fleet had assumed geostationary orbit around Aedris, with its weapon bays and cannons ready to lay waste to the surface. The fire command came a second later, and the heavens lit up with the collimated fire of a Space Marine Legion as it unleashed a controlled instant of lethality. One burst was all it took, one searing instant of precisely calculated fire. Flesh-burning lances struck first, igniting the atmosphere to eliminate the frictional drag on the following ordnance. Kinetic mass-driver munitions hit next, slamming into the surface of the planet like the hammers of gods. Shockwaves spread out in radio sector patterns, sending tectonic blasts along mathematically precise vectors. Conventional warheads followed, pounding the earth in stepped barrages, marching outwards in repeating waves. Incendiaries razed the target zone flat, vitrifying the rock and burning away whatever organic material might remain on the surface. A cone of fire gouged the surface of Aedris, burning, pounding and flattening in the blink of an eye structures that had stood inviolate for tens of thousands of years. A barren ring of pulverized earth encircled the citadel of Amon Nishak Kalis, leaving its walls, towers and temples an isolated island cut off from the rest of the planet's structures by a billowing firestorm of planet-cracking force. And in its wake came a blooming haze of iron and violet steel. Flocks of thunderhawks, storm birds, warhawks, and heavy planetary landers launched from crammed embarkation decks. Bulk tenders descended to low orbit and disgorged thousands of troop carriers, armor lifters, and supply barks. Titanic gravity-cushioned mass landers moved with majestic slowness as two battle engines of Legio Mortis took to the field, and this was but the first wave of the invasion. Another 8 would follow, before the martial power of 2 entire Space Marine legions and their auxiliary forces had made planetfall. But Aedris was fighting back. Forex knew it was nonsense to think like that, but that was how it felt. Most worlds did not welcome the presence of the Iron Warriors, for the 4th Legion was known to bring ruin and bloodshed in its wake. Not for its legionaries, the cheering crowds and floral-lined triumphal marches enjoyed by the likes of Gilliman's popinjays. But this world seemed to be actively repelling them. The blasted wasteland of Ground Zero was a glassy plain of powdered rubble and blackened fragments of some unknown material. What might once have been an area of awe-inspiring architecture from a bygone age of a fallen civilization had been razed more thoroughly than any barbarian horde had ever left a city of old Roma. The landing zone was awash with thousands of armored vehicles, supply camps, munition depots, and fuel silos. Clouds of toxic fumes gathered overhead like looming thunderheads from the armada of tracked fury ready to bear the Iron Warriors and Emperor's children to the sepulchre of Isha's doom. Battalions of mobile artillery strained to be unleashed, and hardened magazines of wall-shattering ordnance had already been built to service their insatiable hunger. A great army awaited the order to attack, but its drop site was yet to be declared secure. Within minutes of the first Iron Warrior's ship landing, Perturabo's legion had begun the task of building fortifications to shelter the invading force and protect their chain of supply from orbit. Towers and walls were raised in the time it took to unload a single cargo bay. Modular construction patterns, natural affinity, and centuries of practice making the task as natural as breathing. The Emperor's children dropped in the wake of the Iron Warriors, their maddened carnival of lunatic mortals disgorging onto the surface of the planet in a panoply of shrieks, insanity, and waving banners. Fulgrim's warriors followed their devotees onto the surface, basking in the adulation and forming up with a rigour that had surprised Forex. Resplendent in their battle armour of gold and purple, iron and bronze, Fulgrim and Perturabo climbed to the peak of the first tower Forex had built and took in the vista of the city-sized sepulchre they were to capture.
"A city of the dead," Perturabo had remarked.
"But one to recognise that there is beauty in death," Fulgrim had responded. Forex was forced to agree. The orbital augurs had failed utterly to capture the scale and drama of the place. Not even Fulgrim's hyperbolic tale-telling in the Thaleochron had come close to the sheer immensity of the Eldar tomb city. With relentless inevitability, the Iron Warriors were fortifying the landing zone. But where the rock of Hydra Cordatis had welcomed the blades of their picks and augurs like a lover, this world rejected them. It resisted their giant digging machines. It mocked their Leviathan earth movers, and not a stone was laid that didn't have to be reinforced beyond all expectations. 3 hours in theatre, and the initial contravelations were still unfinished. Forex was livid, loudly berating the new machina, his underlings and his sapper crews, but there was little to be done. High, spike-topped walls were stretching around the vast acreage of the deployment zone, much slower than Forex had ever known, but lengthening with every passing minute. Forex moved down the line of this newest segment, the heaving, belching, grinding engines of the new machina, like colossally industrious worker ants pasting together a hive for their queen from sheet metal, liquid permacrete, high tensile rebars, and ultra-dense hardcore. Walls like this could take a hit from a starship's macro cannon and remain standing. Blockhouses, barracks and strong points were worked into the fabric of the walls, and battalions of Seleucid Thorakite were already occupying them. Dust from the orbital bombardment hung in the air like granular mist, hazing the strange light in the sky. From orbit, the planet's environment had appeared serene, but from the ground, it was anything but. A keening wail filled the air, like a plaintive cry at the threshold of hearing. Some strange side effect of the bombardment, or a lingering echo of some local phenomenon? Either way, it was a disquieting sound, part lament, part hostile curse. Strange colours swirled in the choked sky, a ceiling of pus yellow, spinning matter ejections of bruised purple and red, and vomited froths of bilious green. All lit by the noctilucent glow from Amon Nyshak Kalis. The lambent emerald light seeped into the sky from beyond the wall, as though the stone of the distant sepulchre were irradiated. It oozed over the landscape, sluggish and lethargic, bathing the invasion forces in a poisonous green glow. Forex's dislike for this place was only getting worse. He watched scurrying riveter slaves, following in the wake of a towering smoke-belching machine that swallowed debris and excreted preformed blocks of hardened stone, enjoying the repetitive rhythm of their work. The engine's hydraulic jaws crushed gathered stone, and its piston-driven hammers pounded the blocks into shape, ready for its rear-mounted lifter gear to haul into place. Forex knelt to examine where the shaped stone met the ground, seeing a web of hair-fine cracks spreading from the sloped base. Already the walls needed strengthening, and he shook his head in disbelief. The new machina engines had moved on, an implacable process of construction that was much slower than he demanded, but which was still unstoppable. Forex reached a set of ironwork stairs bolted to the walls and climbed their scissoring height to the ramparts, emerging onto a covered walkway of overhanging kinetic hoardings, murder holes and grenade dumpers. Designed to secure a landing site or prevent an enemy force from relieving a besieged city, the walls were square-edged and hard-lined, the very antithesis of this world's organic architecture. All around the landing zone, the vast bomb-raised plain stretched to the horizon in all directions, an exclusion zone made secure by the orbital bombardment. Nothing moved on this flattened wasteland. Only glittering reflections and drifting banks of smoke broke the uniform emptiness. Despite the bleakness of the landscape, Forex could not escape the feeling of being watched, as though a host of unseen observers were studying him, assessing him, and determining his worth. Forex shook off the sensation and stalked the ramparts. Iron warriors from the 134th Grand Battalion and the Thorakites manned the walls. The officers gave him nods of respect as he passed. Forex crossed the rampart, staring at the distant city he and his fellow warriors were to put asunder. It was a city of elegantly proportioned towers, with fluted leaf domes, sweeping walls that were gracefully defensible, and arcing bridges of such slender dimensions that it must surely be impossible they could bear any weight. The city was alive with temples of gilded roofs, sepulchres that celebrated the lives of those interred beneath, and mausolea of such grand scale that only an emperor would be worthy to lie within. The city was haloed on the far horizon by a disk of monstrous blackness, the terrifying black sun that lay at the heart of the Eye of Terror. It was an emerald city in the shadow of a nightmarish power that could devour it with a single inhalation. Yet, for all the city's beauty, there was no mistaking its hollow emptiness. Nothing lived here. Nothing had ever lived here, nor ever would. The stone wrought had said it best when he stepped from the belly of a storm bird. Placing one palm on the ground, Vulbron had shaken his head and said, "This world is dead. It has no soul. The rock will not stand." Overly poetic, perhaps, but for once Forex knew exactly what the stone wrought meant. 3 kilometres farther along the wall, Barban Falk stared at the rising section of bastion before him, his breath coming in short, wheezing hikes. The same grinning skull face he'd seen on the bridge of the Iron Blood was leering back at him from the cracks in the crumbling stonework of a toothed Merlon that had fallen from the battlements. "No," he hissed, "I am not seeing this."
"Denial," a keening voice in his head seemed to laugh. "How unoriginal."
Falk shook his head and tore his gaze from the phantom image, striding down the length of the construction and forcing his mind to concentrate on the details of his Grand Battalion's work. Fresh sections of wall were being lifted in by enormous crane engines under the supervision of his warriors and beaten into place by titanic siege robots with hammers the size of land raiders. Falk felt an insistent tugging on the frayed edges of his mind, a wheedling, insistent pressure carried on the sighing cries of the wind that compelled him to pause and stare at the newest section of wall like a malfunctioning servitor. At first, He saw nothing out of the ordinary, but then the arrangement of stress lines, runnels of permacrete and hissing rivets at the base of the wall seemed to cohere into that familiar deathly face, as though skillfully placed there by an artist who desired an audience of one. He blinked, and the image was gone. But no sooner had he turned away than he saw it billowing in a dust cloud, shaped by an arc of the new machina's crane limbs, or formed in a scattering of superfluous offcuts. Falk shut his eyes, letting the image of the grotesque skull fall from his mind, even as he heard it scratching at his thoughts like an animal left out in the dark. He released a shuddering breath and forced himself to look back at the work as it progressed. The grinning, fleshless face met his gaze, and this time there was no mistaking the voice in his head.
"Bob and Falk," it said, "a name for he who will be nameless."
Kroger hated this world like he had hated no other. The shimmering green glow from the distant sepulchre tainted everything with a sickly illumination, fraying Kroger's already short temper. Since making planetfall, nothing had gone as planned. Machines had failed, stone had crumbled, and metal had warped beyond usable tolerances. He bit back an angry curse as yet another portion of the wall footing sank into the rock, leaving the split line flush with the surface. Dust billowed from the sunken blocks, necessitating yet another halt in the work as heavy lifter machines with bright carapaces and fluttering cog banners rolled in on wide tracks to haul them from the ground. Gangs of robotic and cybernetic slaves dragged long bars of rust-coloured steel to add yet more reinforcement to the foundation trench.
"Another delay this campaign can ill afford," said Harker, with a weary resignation Kroger only half believed.
"I know," he snapped in reply. "My first war action as Triarch, and I'm behind in every element of our projected advance. Might as well have myself buried in the foundations." Harker held out a data slate with crawling lines of progress reports. "Every other warsmith is encountering similar delays."
"I don't care about them," said Kroger. "All I care about is that I'm on schedule. The sooner this work is complete, the sooner we can attack that cursed sepulchre and get off this world."
The growling roars of the construction engines cleared Kroger's thoughts as a cloud of filthy blue oil smoke enveloped them. Cursing, he moved clear, hearing the grinding crack of splitting stone as the earth-moving leviathans fought to remove the subsided blocks from ground that now seemed to want to grip them tightly.
"Some strong words with the new machina might speed things up," suggested Harker.
"My thoughts exactly," said Kroger, pushing through the silent ranks of servitors as a block was wrenched from the ground and broke apart in a cascade of crumbling fragments. The servitors ignored him, and Kroger saw a trio of black-robed magi arguing in crackling binary at the edge of a rubble-filled trench that was supposed to be heavy with foundation stones. Multiple holographic images of ground-penetrating Auspex readings haloed one of the priests, and Kroger felt his anger focus on this inhuman hybrid. The Magos waved multiple augmetic arms as he directed the work of whipped slave gangs with blurts of binaric nonsense. Before Kroger even knew it, his sword was in his hand, his thumb pressing the activation stud. One economical swing, and the machine priest fell to the ground, hacked down from shoulder to groin. A squealing roar of machine pain erupted from his augmenters, which was swiftly silenced as the organic components of the priest collapsed in a clatter of metal and a wash of oily blood. The remaining new machina priests retreated from the sudden death of their leader, barking furious scraps of machine code. Kroger put a bolt round through the gleaming half-flesh, half-iron skull of the nearest and brought the smoking barrel to bear on the last hooded priest. The new machina's agent balked at Kroger's rage and loosed a burst of panicked binary. Kroger eased the hammer back on his pistol.
"Gothic," he said. Do you speak it?
The priest nodded, and Kroger heard a series of wetly metallic clicks, as whatever passed for vocal cords, were rearranged beneath its hood.
I do, Warsmith, said the priest. Enhancement, as did my compatriots.
I'm sure they did, but they're both dead, and now you're in charge of this wall's construction, said Kroger. So tell me, what's the damn hold-up?
You understand the difficulties we face? Asked the priest.
I do, said Kroger, and I don't care. Just get this bastard wall built.
The priest pressed on, resigned to or uncaring of Kroger's volatile temper.
Clarification. Then you must also be aware that this ground is not conforming to any known model of geological dynamics in the Martian records. Its measured strength is not matching up to the reality of our build parameters.
Here's some clarification for you, said Kroger, pulling the trigger.
Harker knelt beside the corpses and flipped back the hood of the last priest. Nothing was left of the man's face, only a snake's nest of cables twitching from the ragged stump of neck. Pumping squirts of black bioorganic fluid spilled into the trench. The stink was all chemicals and spoiled meat.
Those were some strong words, said Harker. Get me some more new machina priests, snapped Kroger, ones that know how to build a damn foundation.
Kroger turned on his heel.